Well, thank you so much, David, for the very kind introduction. I had to think about who he was really talking about there for a few minutes. Didn't sound like me at all. So about 8 or 9 months ago, David and I met in Fowler's Grove and went to a Starbucks. And he said, "Hey, I just want to get to know you a little bit better and spend some time with you." And I think he was kind of vetting me to see if maybe he would invite me to come out here and speak. And he obviously ultimately did. So this has been building up in my heart for about 8 or 9 months. But what was unique about that Starbucks visit is, you know, they always ask you, "What's the name?" so they can put it on the cup. And I just thought really quick, I was in a playful mood. I said, "Well, I'm Jesus and this is Saves." So a few minutes later when they presented the cups, they're like, "Jesus Saves." we made him say it, and David was filming it on his phone. I was like, "Yes, forget Merry Christmas, man. Jesus Saves, bro." So you guys can go ahead and use that one and cause the Starbucks baristas to be really uncomfortable, if you'd like. So I'll just go through kind of my history real quick. Not because I need to hear it again. There's some folks here that may not have, been at an event that I spoke at before. So I just want you to know that he wasn't kidding when he said I was a BA. I'm kidding. I'm totally kidding. So I joined the Army at 17. It required my parents to sign a waiver for me to join because I wasn't 18 yet. And I don't know why, but I thought that was going to be really difficult. It was one of the easiest things I ever got my parents to do. I'm still trying to figure that out. My dad was smiling when he signed. But went off to the Army, Fort Leonard, Missouri. I wanted to do the roughest, toughest, coolest thing that I could find, and at that point was the 82nd Airborne Division. So, yeah, HUA, right? HUA actually stands for Heard, Understood, and Acknowledged. I never knew that all the years I was saying HUA, right? So I did 3 years, 11 months in the 82nd Airborne Division. Actually jumped out of the Army for a little while. Worked for my local church there in Fayetteville. The Gulf War started to spin up. A lady called me on the phone and said, "Hey, if the need arises, are you willing to go?" And I was like, "I bleed red, white, and blue. Of course I'm willing to go." Well, she didn't tell me. They had already sent me orders putting me back on duty. I literally got them the next day, reported back to Fort Bragg. And the rest, as they say, is history. I was coming out of the PX one day, and a guy had a television with a video, and these guys were skydiving and shooting around corners and open sea kayaking, all this cool stuff. And I was like, "Hey, how do you do that?" And he goes, "Sign right there." And I don't mind if I do. And little did I know I was signing up for the Special Forces Assessment and Selection Program called SFAS, also known as School for Advanced Suffering. And went through 3 weeks of selection process to actually just earn the right to start training as a Green Beret. The SEALs complain about their hell week. Well, ours is 21 days. It's hell 3 weeks. And I do need to tell you at this point that I actually tried to get into the SEALs halfway through my career, but they weren't taking heterosexuals, so I stayed Army. So, yeah. Just kidding. They're great Americans. I don't want to hurt their feelings. So I made it through all the training. I became a Special Forces medic. Everybody's a shooter first, but then you have specialties that you specialize in. I picked medic because it was the longest, hardest course, and I had something to prove. Ended up spending five and a half years on a scuba team, then made the jump over to the unit. You may have seen the show on TV. It's nothing like that in real life. Just under 2 years in Delta, went back to 7th Special Forces Group and finished out my career in a unit called C-37. It's what we call a gray side unit. It's kind of hidden in plain view, and we'll deploy and do things in other countries with a stated mission, but in reality, behind the scenes, we're kind of doing other things as well. So it's a gray unit. We do white stuff and black side operations as well. Retired from that in 2008, was immediately hired by, it as Amtrak, the train company. It has its own police force. They were standing up a counterterrorism unit and I was hired to build, develop, and run the one based in Los Angeles, or two, one in D.C., one in L.A. I did that for 3 years, jumped out of that into the private security sector, and about 18, 20 months ago, I ran into Pete, the Australian guy that David was speaking of. Since then, it's been kind of a crazy ride. I've been involved with ministry before on a local church level, everything from teaching classes to actively going out and street preaching and things like that. This ministry, Destiny Rescue, and rescuing girls out of human trafficking has stretched me in ways that I'd never been stretched before. It's been an exciting time to see God do some of the things that he's done. And at the same time, it's been kind of a new experience to see the depth in the darkness that even in special operations, you kind of bump up against it when you're looking for bad guys in other countries. But in this job, not job, but ministry, we're purposely leaving the light and going into the darkness. And I said I wasn't going to do this. So we purposely go into the darkest places, and you see some of the darkest stuff. And it'll jack you up emotionally. And yeah, I'm tearing up a little bit, but like David said, if you laugh at me, I will kill you. So I want to talk to you this morning about unidirectional commitment. And that's a phrase I brought up or developed on my own as I was studying for this. Unidirectional commitment. You've heard it maybe talked about in other ways. Focus in your life. But focus just ended up kind of having a different characteristic than unidirectional commitment. To talk about this, I want to tell you a story that happened last week while I was on my 10th trip to the Dominican Republic. To go down there and work with Destiny Rescue. So I got to back up and say, what we do is we go into bars and brothels and we walk the streets and we play the role of a client. So we actually pretend to be Johns looking for prostitutes. We actually pretend to be perverts looking for underage trafficked girls. So we play an investigative role, and one of the things that's absolutely vital to doing that is covert surveillance equipment. For example, the watch that I'm wearing right now is actually a camera with IR lights and everything in it. If we were in a very loud disco kind of scene, it has the ability to separate out the ambient noise and pick up your voice alone. And when you play the video back, you know, in the club, it was like, you know, and all that stuff going on, but it'll actually separate that, and you can hear the guy saying, oh, hey, I'll charge you this much for the 9-year-old or whatever, and so we have equipment like that. It's very expensive, and I actually had to tap into, I'm not crying now, I'm just clearing my throat. I had to tap into some friends and ask for help to develop and buy a kit of covert surveillance equipment. Thank you so much. Excuse me. And the kit ended up costing about $7,000. And I'm not going to embarrass you too much, but Greg Palmer was very, very instrumental in helping us do that. He kind of led that charge, and I know he donated quite a bit out of his own pockets to help us put that kit together. It's taken me a few months to get down to Dom Rep. Well, I flew down last Tuesday, a week ago Tuesday, so 10 days ago, with this $7,000 kit. And some former Delta cohorts of mine from a company called TSE Recon, you can go check out their website. They got some of the coolest stuff in the world, and you can buy it. It's cool. But they put this kit together. So it came in a big Pelican case, you know, those hard cases. The case alone is like $150. And when you opened it, every system had its own little bag, and it's labeled, and there was like a book you open, and it had all the instructions. It was just very, very professionally done. So fast forwarding, we've been working with the Dominican government, and I actually have a signed document from their Justice Department authorizing me to have that gear, employ that gear, and perform investigative work in their country. Super hard to get that permission down there, but we worked feverishly to get it, and they finally signed a document. So I actually have that permission. So I didn't think twice about going into country with it. Well, this may come as a surprise to you. This never happens in the U.S., but in the Dominican, it did. The Justice Department doesn't speak with customs. So you already see where this is going. So I show up with my suitcase and this really nice-looking, expensive hard case with locks on it. So on my 9 other trips to Dominican Republic, I go through the immigration, bam, bam, they stamp my passport. And this time, I've been down there so many times, the lady looked at me, she goes, "So when are you staying permanently?" Right? So, because I've been going down there quite a bit. So you get through there, and then you hand a paper to the customs guy. And 9 times, I've handed it to him and walked right past. Well, this time, I watched the guy's eyes go down to the case, back up to me, he smiled, and he pointed at the line. And it was at that point I went, "Oh, crap, this is going to go badly," right? So I go over into the line, and the guy comes over, and he says, "Open the case," in Spanish, all this transpiring in Spanish. I'll go ahead and translate for you this morning, right? So he says, "Open the case," and I open it, and I'm like, okay, big world, little Tim, right? You know, start big. What is this? It's cameras. You know, I'm not going to get specific and make him work for the answers, right? So he's like, "Well, what kind of cameras?" And I'm like, "You know, just cameras, you know, the ones that take pictures." And I wasn't trying to be smart, but I was just trying to be very vague. So I could see it on his face. He didn't get it. So he starts digging more and more and more. End of the story is 3.5 hours later, they're saying, "This is illegal equipment in my country. You can't bring it in." I'm showing a document on my phone. I'm like, "Look, it's signed by your federal judge. I am authorized to have it." So they're going back to the big office to talk with the big boss, and they keep coming out and going back in, and I'm sitting there holding my head in my hands going, "Oh, why didn't I think about having a cop meet me to get me through?" And, you know, like I used to do in the military, we'd have an embassy person show up and, you know, whatever. I just didn't think of it because I had that document. And so they finally said, "Well, look, you're going to have to leave this with us." And I'm like, "Oh, that's not going to happen." You know, I've been to places in the world where they would steal the steam off a pile of feces. You know what I mean? It's just, and not that they would do that. I'm just saying. And so I was like, "Yeah, that's not going to happen. I'll sleep here with the gear." And the guy goes back into the big office and comes back out and he goes, "Okay, well, you know, if you're going to sleep here, you got to sleep over there outside the secure area. And our office opens at 8. I was like, "Dude, he's really serious. He's going to make me do this." So I'm like, "Okay, this isn't going to work. I haven't eaten in like 9 hours. And so here's what we're going to do. We're going to take photos of all the gear. We're going to log it all, and you're going to give me a hand receipt." He goes, "Okay." I was like, "Okay, that's easy." So we did it. So I had at least a paper with somebody's signature saying that I just left $7,000 worth of gear at customs. So in with that kit, I brought 3 holsters, 2 magazine holders, and 6 magazines for 3 of the police officers that I was working with down there. Greg also helped me purchase that gear. Greg gave me a lot of trouble right last week. So they were all oohing and aahing over that, and I thought, "I'll never see that gear again. They'll just take that." So I leave, and I spend the next 2 days trying to get my gear back. So Tuesday night, I leave. They say, "Hey, the office is already closed. There's nothing we can do." I leave the gear with a hand receipt. So the next morning, I'm on the phone trying to call all the people that I know to try to get this gear back. Stay with me. I know this is dragging on, but this gets really good here in a second. So Wednesday goes through. I'm in business meetings all day, and nothing happens. I know I'm flying back Friday, so I'm like, "We got to, you know, get this hopping. We got to get to the right person that has the authority to tell somebody to do something or not do something." So the next day, I'm on the phone on Thursday all morning. "Hey, can you help me? You know, what can you do? calling the judge that signed the document. Hey, you're the one who gave us permission. Is there any influence you can sway over this situation? And everybody's like, let me see what I can do. Let me see what I can do. Nobody is definitive in any way. So I end up on Thursday midday going through a human trafficking conference for 2.5 hours. As I go into the conference, I'm trying to call this female colonel of the National Police, Colonel Hernandez. And I'm ringing, no answer. Ringing, no answer. I'll wait 10 minutes. Ringing, no answer. So I sit through this conference. We get out of the conference. My mind's still on this equipment because we're really limited in what we can do without the equipment. So I try to call this colonel again. She picks up. She's in Santo Domingo. That's where their main office is. It's 3 hours away. And I said, hey, this is who I am. This is what I'm doing. Can you be of help to me? She says, where are you? This is where God starts to intervene, so pay attention. She says, where are you? I'm like, what does that matter? You're 3 hours away in Santo Domingo, right? I said, well, I'm in Verón, the city of Verón. She's like, oh, okay, where? Okay, well, if you got to know, I'm by Cortecito, the area of Cortecito in Verón. And she's like, okay, where? I'm like, you know, I'm trying not to give some smart aleck response, which is very, you know, not common with me. And I said, well, if you got to know, I'm pulling into the Texaco station next to the Cortecito Hotel. She says, oh, good, I'll be there in 1 minute. What? So I hang up the phone, and I'm standing there, and in comes this car, and out steps this female colonel who I had sat 3 seats from in the human trafficking conference. And I was wearing a Superman shirt. She goes, oh, Superman, right? And I'm like, oh, I hope this is good, right? So she goes, explain to me what's going on. So I explain to her what's going on. And she goes, okay, let me make some phone calls. A couple hours pass, and I get a phone call. This is Thursday night now. Now, remember, I'm flying out Friday. And the phone call goes like this. Señor Timothy, you are wanted in our country. There is a warrant for your arrest. You are wanted for espionage and illegal importation of weapons. And I'm like, oh, this is really not good, right? So they deemed that equipment suitable for the use of espionage, which I guess, yeah, you could use it for that. That's not what we're using it for, at least daily. And then they consider a magazine for a weapon as part of the weapon. You have to have special licenses to import that. And so I was a wanted man on Thursday. So I'm thinking now, oh, man, I'm flying back tomorrow. How is this going to work? So all of my training kicks in. The whole fight or flight response kicks in. And I'm going, okay, if I call this guy, even though I hate SEALs and they hate me, maybe I can get them to come from Puerto Rico because it's a 4-hour ride. I've done it in a go-fast boat. And they can come and meet me at a grid coordinate on the beach, and I can be off, and I'm out of here because I am not going to stay all weekend in a Dominican prison protecting my virginity, right? So that goes through my head, and I'm like, yeah, no, I'm probably not going to get any SEALs to do that. Well, maybe I can drive and hop the border into Haiti, go to Port-au-Prince, and I'll fly back from there. But if I do that, then I can't ever come back to the country because they're going to know I did it. And you see what I mean? So I'm going through moral and ethical dilemmas and all this going through my head. And I'm like, what do I do? You know, think, what was it in Johnny, in Rambo? You know, think Johnny, right? I'm thinking, grabbing gas cans and, you know, trying to figure out how I'm going to get out of this. So while all that's going on Friday, the Colonel Hernandez, the female colonel, says, I want you to call this guy at the embassy, Jose in Santiago. He works for ICE, Immigration Customs Enforcement, for the U.S. So I'm like, interesting. So I call Jose, who I had the foresight to brief 9 months ago on what we were doing, how we were doing it, who we were working with, and a little bit of my background. I didn't give him the whole picture. I try not to do that unless I'm at a speaking engagement and David tells everybody that I served in Delta, right? So, thanks for blowing out my secret, bro, wherever you are. So I call Jose on. He's like, yeah. He goes, yeah, I've been tracking this for about a day and a half. He's like, you're in a lot of trouble, man. I'm like, that's not what I want to hear, bro. So I'm like, all right, dude, talk me through this. What do I got to do to clear us, you know, and stop this international incident from spinning out of control? Because it was literally just getting worse and worse as time went. And he goes, well, give me a minute. I'll call you right back. So he got off the phone, called someone. I didn't know at the time who it was. He calls me right back. He goes, all right, here's the deal. Your equipment is right now located at the J2, called Jota Dos. It's the military intelligence branch of their intelligence apparatus. So basically the DIA of the CIA, right? The Defense Intelligence Agency. And I'm like, oh man, this is either good or bad. And he goes, well, I'm going to text you this guy's number. As soon as you hang up, call him. And I'm like, okay, they're triangulating my phone. They know where I'm at. As soon as I call this guy, it's going to be like, woo, you know, like NCIS LA or something. They're going to come in, swoop, and take me. So I'm like, okay, roger that. I'll call him. So hang up. I call this number, and a guy named Colonel Ramirez answers. He says, hola, Colonel Ramirez. I'm like, you know, buenos dias, senor. You know, this, I use my code name. This is Logan. And he goes, who are you? And I said, in Spanish, I go, I'm the gringo who has been causing all of your butt pain for about 2 days. And this guy belly laughs on the phone. Oh! And I thought, oh, thank God. If he's belly laughing, it can't be that serious, right? So he starts to ask me questions. He goes, tell me what's going on. So I told him the whole story up till then. He goes, okay, you're going to get your equipment back on Monday. No problem. We'll just give it back to you. When are you leaving? I said, well, take a chance, roll the dice. Do I tell him I'm about to go to the airport? Or I said, well, I'm actually going to the airport right now. He goes, okay, when are you coming back? And I thought, again, a little bit of information that he's not going to try to trip me up there. So I'm like, well, I'm not sure yet. I got to see what my schedule holds. And I'm trying to talk through this. And he goes, well, when are you coming back? And I said, well, I'm thinking he's worried about the gear getting picked up. I said, well, look, I've got an Australian guy and a Dominican guy I work with here. I've given them a power of attorney so they can pick up that gear. He's like, okay, that's great. When are you coming back? So I'm like, okay, he's pushing me into a corner. I got to tell him something. So I said, well, probably the first week in December. He goes, okay, great. Now remember, Thursday night, I was wanted for espionage and illegal transportation and importation of weapons. Okay, this is Friday afternoon, about 1 in the afternoon. He goes, okay, great. When you come back, make sure you schedule a few extra days in. I want you to come to the J2. I want to meet you personally. And then I want to show you all around the J2 so everybody knows who you are. And I'd like to talk to you. The government has tasked me with standing up a brand new counterterrorism unit. Hossein at the embassy tells me a little bit of your background. I think you're ideally suited to help us with that program. So it went from, I'm a wanted man, to, you're going to help us stand up this new program. I literally teared up because only God can do that kind of thing that quickly. So, yeah. So for the last week since that occurred, I have been constantly thinking through what an amazing God we have, and what an amazing ability He has to take circumstances, test our faith, put us through a growth process, and turn out the other end of, with us going, wow, you are so amazing. You are so amazing. So my challenge to you this morning is in your lives, whether you're a business owner, a father in a home, you're leading your family, you're leading employees, you're leading a ministry. I want you to take that story and kind of take it out of context and apply it to your situation. I think of Joseph. Think about that. He's betrayed by his own siblings, thrown in a hole to die. They faked his death, sold him into slavery. He works as a slave, for some say up to 13 years. Thrown into prison, falsely accused of rape. I mean, this guy just can't catch a break. Sounds like he was accused of espionage and illegal transportation of weapons, right? Except over 13 or 14 years. And finally, God turned that around and glorified himself and used Joseph in a magnificent way. Only God can do that. Only God can do that. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, their faith was tried by fire, literally and figuratively. What did God do? God showed up in the fire. God shows up in the fire. We're the only one that has a God that can do that. Moses, he was tried. David, his own son, tried to usurp his throne and perform a coup. Can you imagine the depth of pain of your own child trying to kill you and take your throne? I can't imagine that. Abraham got up and left everything he knew back when there was no civilization to go to, right? He just led all of his family and extended family off into the wilderness. And the trials that came with that had to be incredible. Think about the 12 disciples. How many times were they, quote unquote, sitting at the airport for 3.5 hours feeling this terrible sinking feeling? Like, oh, this isn't going well. Hey, didn't I see you with Jesus? No. I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know the man, right? What a terrible sinking feeling to be in those kinds of situations. To know that the queen's daughter just ordered your head off to be taken off, right? In that one case. So all these situations where you have this terrible sinking feeling, but if we would just have faith enough to step back and say, you know what, Lord, I'm unidirectionally committed to serving you. And if I'm committed, then all this stuff that's happening to the left and the right of me is just ancillary. It's just stuff I'm going to step over. Going back to the Special Forces Assessment and Selection, 21 days, you do all kinds of events. Team events where you're carrying literally hundreds of pounds, plus your 100-pound rucksack. You're pushing Jeeps with the air out of the tires. You get a trailer and one tire is missing and some poles and ropes. And you got to like make a can of lever and pull this thing like a mule. And so it's all kinds of these events that seem to last forever. But when I went through SFAS, I literally weighed about 142 pounds. Not near the giant of a man that I am now, right? 142 pounds. 21 days of absolute pain and suffering. There were guys that were more talented than me. There were guys that were bigger and stronger than me that didn't make it. They didn't make it a couple of days and they were gone. So guys have said, well, what's the difference? My attitude was this, and I'm not kidding. I actually verbalized this back then. I said, I may not make it through this, but if I don't, when they put me in the back of the truck, I'm going to be cold and stiff because I died trying. That is unidirectional commitment. Okay? It's not focus at the cost of everything else. It's focus at the expense of letting other distractions take you away from your goal. Does that make sense? Unidirectional commitment. If we would simply commit ourselves to following Christ, then all of these things that pop up become much, much, much smaller. They're not life-ending things. You know, my wife said something that offended me. You know what? I don't deserve that. You know what? Look, if you're committed to Christ, if you're focused on Christ and serving him, you're going to be like, you know what? She had a bad morning. I think I'll bring her flowers. It's just a speed bump, man. It doesn't become a marriage-altering event then. Because you're not focused on that anymore. You're focused on something that matters. Unidirectional commitment. When things look grim, dark, and lonely, when things seem hard, and you've reached the end of your rope, you're physically not capable of going any longer, unidirectional commitment will allow you to summon the strength, summon the support, to keep on going. It's not any longer, why can't I complete it? It's how can I complete it? Two different mindsets. A couple of things that I'd like you to take with you about unidirectional commitment, and I close. Unidirectional commitment allows you to maintain an attitude in spite of the circumstances. If you read the story of Habakkuk, he maintained his attitude regardless of a paycheck, regardless of a payback. Okay? Unidirectional commitment allows you to surpass your present circumstances and think beyond those. you think to the end. You begin with the end in mind, and the things that you're doing or suffering through in the meantime don't mean as much. If you're a leader, think about this. Nobody commits to things that don't really matter. So if your family's falling apart, ask yourself, why would my kids commit to what we're doing? And you may find an answer there. You find something for your family to unidirectionally commit to, and all of a sudden you'll have buy-in from your kids again, buy-in from your wife again. And they'll get in line behind you because there's a place we're going. There's something we're going to do. It's unidirectional, and that's where we're going. What is it about your goals, your ministry, or your business that's worthy of unidirectional commitment from others? If you got a high employee turnover, ask yourself, why are they here? Why should they stay? Why should I expect commitment from them? An effective leader won't ask, how do I get more commitment? But ask, to what or whom are we committed? Different paradigms. If you're trying to close the back door on your ministry and keep people from leaving, ask yourself, what is it that we're focused on? Where are we going? And try to plug that hole through commitment and a purpose. Effective leadership or Christianity as a whole flows from commitment to the right things. I've talked with guys in the military back when I did that, and then as a federal agent running the counterterrorism unit in Los Angeles, and they said, man, I just can't get ahead. I can't seem to get promoted. I can't seem to get this job I want or whatever. And I started asking them, what are you committed to? What are you doing to achieve that goal? And 9 times out of 10, they weren't committed to anything towards that goal. They were trying to get off early. They were trying to take extra time off. They were trying to focus on other things, and they still wanted to get promoted. So I would just say, what are you committed to that's helping you achieve that? The reverse of that is, if you're committed to the right things, they will help you get there. The successful warrior is the average man with laser-like focus. So I'm going to finish with 2 anecdotes. One, my son, Dawson, who's with me this morning, 2 weekends ago, competed in a CrossFit tournament in Ocala. He's 17 years old, weighs 158 pounds as of last night. 2 weeks ago, he weighed 153 pounds. He entered in the men's division, not the teen division, the men's division. He took first place. He crushed it. A number of times people came up and said, man, he's an amazing athlete. And I said, yeah, you're right, he is, and I'm really proud of him. But what you don't see is the 6 o'clock mornings when he's in the garage and all you hear is the weights. Boom, and you'll pick him up again. Boom, and he keeps picking it up and dropping it, picking up and dropping it, picking up and dropping it. He's unidirectionally focused, and it's absolutely given him success in what he's doing. I finish with this. I was a Special Forces Assessment and Selection cadre back in 1995, I think. And the last event that we have candidates do is a 26.5-mile road march. So they put in 100 pounds. They've been going for 3 weeks, sleep deprivation, information deprivation. They're hurting. They're crushed physically. But we make them do this road march. And at that time, I was working as a medic. So I would have this truck, pickup truck, and it was kind of outfitted as an ambulance in the back. And I would rove the whole route to make sure guys weren't hurt, cheating, sleeping, whatever. And I'm coming down the dirt road, and on the side they kind of plow it so it has a little berm on the side. And this guy, usually if you saw a guy sitting there with his rucksack on and he was doctoring his feet or something, he's just taking care of his feet. He's going to get back up and keep moving. Well, I see this guy and his rucksack sitting next to him. So I'm like, what do we have here? So I pull up, get out of the truck. And we're always wearing glasses during daytime because we're supposed to be stoic and aloof, right? So I walk up and with my glasses on, you know, you don't even look directly at him. And I purposely would lower my voice like this. And I'd say, candidate, is there a problem? And this guy goes into this dissertation. Oh, Sergeant, I just can't go anymore. I'm spent. I'm done. I just can't go another step. Well, I know what day it is, and I know where he's at. So I look to my right and left. We're not supposed to encourage them. We're not supposed to, hey, come on, nothing. Usually what we'd say is, what were your instructions, right? If they ask a question, hey, Sergeant, what do I do about this? Candidate, what were your instructions? You know, that's it. No information. So I looked left, I looked right, and I said, hey, get up, put your rucksack on, and move out. Oh, Sergeant, I can't go another step. I'm done. I raised my voice a little bit, said, is that your final answer? Roger that, Sergeant. Okay. I opened the tailgate of the truck. I said, put your stuff in there. Magically, he had the strength and energy to pick up 100 pounds and throw it in the truck and leap right up in there. I was like, okay. I closed the truck, drove about 400 yards up around the corner, pulled over, opened the back of the tailgate. There's some other candidates sitting off to the side. He goes, what are you doing? You're not taking me back? I said, get out of the truck, candidate. He goes, what is this? I said, this is the finish line. Get out of the truck. He started weeping. He said, Sergeant, I'll run back to the point. I'll go farther, and then I'll turn. I'll run all the way. I was like, no, you will not. You will get your stuff out of my truck and sit right over there. You voluntarily withdrew yourself from the course. Now move. Unidirectional commitment will not let you quit. And I just want to make sure before you leave here, if you're struggling with your marriage, if you're thinking about quitting on a ministry, if you're thinking about making a life change that's going to hurt your family, you fit your own situation into there. I just want to encourage you, do not voluntarily withdraw yourself from the fight. Do not raise your hand and say, I'm done. You go and you work and you walk and you struggle and you fight. Even when you've been sitting at the airport for 3.5 hours and it doesn't look good. Right? When the chips are down, that's when you don't quit. You're men. You dig your heels in and you move forward. And that's my word for you today. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, I thank you for these men. Please make us all unidirectionally committed to serving you. When we do that, everything else just pales in importance. Thank you for them being here. Bless each one of these lives that's represented. Bless their homes, bless their businesses, bless their ministries. And may you be glorified in all that's said and done. We pray this in Christ's name. Amen.